We have with us live in the studios once again, Jav Parrish, formerly co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
All right. No Maria this week. It should be the final, we're hoping, last week of her trip to...
Aruba, wasn't it? It sounds nice.
It's never actually been revealed to us. It's a need-to-know basis.
Yes.
In case we call her. All right. So jumping in this week with turns out the Woodland Park Zoo elephants have something in similar with the Baltimore Colts, for those of you ancient enough to remember.
Oh, yeah. Like getting in a big truck and moving in the middle of the night. Yeah. Is that what you're referring to?
That's what I was referring to.
Yeah, it sort of was a cap to the many years of activism and the dubious good faith in which the Woodland Park Zoo has operated for much of that time. That in the middle of this week, I think it was on Wednesday, Woodland Park snuck its two elephants that have been that activists have been demanding be moved to sanctuary. They snuck them out in the evening in trucks to try and avoid protests by activists, and they're sending them to the another zoo, not sanctuary, another zoo in Oklahoma City, which Woodland Park officials claim will be a better habitat for the elephants. And by all accounts, Oklahoma City does in fact have a better program for the large mammals than Woodland Park does, but that unfortunately is a low bar, and that's part of what the activists have been talking about all these many years. But the problem is that zoos in general are a bad place for animals of that size, which is why they've been pushing for sanctuary. Now, at the moment, those elephants are they got waylaid in the trucks that were carrying them. They're now sitting in San Diego because of a change in route that was forced by weather conditions throughout the Rocky Mountains. So they're now down in California, and activists are hoping that they will be diverted to sanctuary in California rather than going on to Oklahoma City. And there is still some effort. I know that Councilmember Shama Sawant had been working with Woodland Park and with a number of other city officials to try and find a sanctuary solution to the elephants. But Woodland Park went ahead and shipped that out even as that process was happening. Once again, not very good faith by zoo officials, and that begs the question of what's to happen to a number of other animals that are housed by Woodland Park in what are less than appropriate conditions for animals, especially larger animals and animals that really don't belong in this particular climate. You have large tropical animals in a marine Pacific climate that is pretty cool much of the year and pretty rainy much of the year. And not a real good place for them. So I'm sure that that issue is not going to go away, even if the elephants have.
Boy, when you said waylaid for a second there, I thought you were going to say that they had done a jailbreak similar to what the bees on I-5 and I-405 did earlier in the week.
But no, it's not a Disney movie in which the intrepid animals get a break out from the zoo and go on an adventure on some or another interstate, but nope, didn't happen.
All right, moving on. Developments this week regarding Shell Oil's Arctic rig.
Yeah, some very big things leave town and some others head in. In this case, it's the how's that for a transition? The Shell Arctic drilling rig that is headed to the Arctic Ocean to extract more fossil fuels for your driving convenience is heading to Seattle. It had been shipped by the oil giant from Malaysia to the Puget Sound and arrived in Port Angeles yesterday. Now it'll be in Port Angeles for a couple of weeks while the platform that had been holding it, it's lifted off of that platform and put into the water, and then it will be brought into the Port of Seattle in Terminal 5 sometime within the next couple of weeks. They're not giving an exact time. All throughout that last part of the journey into through the Straits of Juan de Fuca and into Port Angeles, the rig and the ship that it had been on, were plagued by Kai activists from the Backbone Campaign, Greenpeace, and various other environmental groups that are trying to stop the rig actually from getting to Seattle, but certainly also drawing attention to the massive environmental consequences of Shell's Arctic drilling program and the complicity of the Port of Seattle in that, and particularly Port Commissioner Bill Bryant, who is widely expected to be the Republican candidate for governor next year in Washington State, and who has been pretty outspoken and pretty proud of his role in bringing Arctic drilling to the Port of Seattle. So look for that direct action to be happening sometime probably in about a week, week and a half in Seattle. And I'm sure Backbone Campaign and Greenpeace and other folks could use all the help they can get in trying to prevent Shell Oil from bringing a pretty massively destructive technology to the Port of Seattle. And to be clear, this is not actually the this is not actually an oil tanker in terms of the risk of spilling oil into Puget Sound, but the drilling rigs themselves also have serious accident and safety records in both in the Arctic and in transport to and from the Arctic. And that's one of the things that people are also pointing out above and beyond the consequences of oil drilling in the Arctic and its implications both for the environment and for climate change.
All right. Moving on then to national and FBI entrapment schemes.
Yeah, we've been talking pretty regularly as they happen over the past several years, really since 9/11, how the FBI has been using the war on terror as a pretext for essentially trying to recruit people into jihad schemes and then busting them, usually clueless teenagers or young men who are disaffected in one way or another, but would never dream on their own of participating in mass murder, but get talked into it by the FBI, and as soon as they agree, boom, they're in jail for many, many years to come. This entrapment scheme was in northern Illinois, in Aurora, outside Chicago, where the FBI, once again, going through social media sites, coaxing people to saying enough that the FBI can have a pretext to arrest them as terrorists. A pair of cousins in this case in Aurora, Illinois. The focus was a member of the Army National Guard in Illinois, one Hassan Edmonds, who was friended on Facebook by an FBI informant who got him to say he intended to join ISIS or be martyred trying. By itself wouldn't seem to be a punishable offense, but nonetheless, high-profile arrests and much chest beating by the FBI and other law enforcement agencies that were preventing terror and keeping the homeland safe and ruin somebody's life, or in this case, a couple of cousins' lives for many years to come. The other thing with these cases in many instances is that once the headlines are over and the actual charges are filed, the charges often wind up being dropped to something much less serious and or not prosecuted at all, or they go to a jury or a judge and lesser charges are agreed upon or they're found not guilty entirely. That seems to be the arc for many of these media stories. But in some cases, people do go to jail for a long period of time, and the practice by the FBI and by law enforcement agencies in general of entrapping these young men continues and is very, very questionable.
And Facebook being a key methodology, a key platform for people who are being entrapped.
Yeah, it's not like the FBI, well, I'm sure they're doing this too, but it's not like the primary focus now is going to mosques and joining them and having undercover informants that way. That takes entirely too much time and effort. The FBI has discovered that going on social media sites and getting people to say things is actually much more efficient in terms of generating headlines and getting the funding they want.
So, and it appears to be something that law enforcement does fairly regularly, befriending people via Facebook.
Yeah, so you know, be aware that sometimes that new friend that you've made seems to have not really had an account until 3 weeks ago. There might be a reason for that.
All right. Moving on to North Carolina.
Yeah, this week in New Tactics for Creative Anti-Abortion Extremism takes us to notably crazy legislature in North Carolina. Of course, that could be said of a number of state legislatures these days, but North Carolina seems to be quite regularly in the headlines for this sort of thing. And House Bill 465 in North Carolina bans, among other things, and you know the usual laundry list punitive restrictions for reproductive rights for women. In this case, it also bans medical school personnel from performing abortions. Now, that might seem like kind of a minor point, except when you consider that if you have, and North Carolina only has two medical schools in the entire state for a population that's actually a little bit larger than Washington State's, if you have medical schools unable to teach new med students and new doctors how to perform abortions, eventually nobody knows how to do them. And this, I would expect to be a clever you know, in this case, seemingly innocuous, but not innocuous at all provision that we're going to see in a number of other states as well. So something to be aware of as yet another tactic in the endlessly creative effort by anti-choice people to try and make illegal something that has been found to be constitutional and legal by the U.S. Supreme Court and has been done so for over 40 years now. It should be settled law, but as we're seeing, it's being steadily eroded away in many, many states. Washington State, where those rights are constitutionally protected, is actually one of the few that has that level of protection for reproductive rights. So it's a pretty serious issue in a lot of the country where those rights have been eroded or evaporated entirely.
So is this a House bill that has passed or?
It has not passed, but it is expected to pass, which is the concern. We're at the point in time in a lot of state legislatures that follow a similar calendar to Washington State's where they convene in the first of the year and the legislation starts passing in March, April, May. So we're getting to the point where a lot of these kind of bills are starting to pass now.
All right. And this, do you know, obviously, we hear about ALEC and its cookie-cutter bills that are proposed in different states. Does this have any tie to ALEC that we know of?
Not that we know of, but again, we've seen this this pattern now where once something is introduced in one state, it's picked up and promulgated by ALEC or other national organizations, and similar bills then pop up in a number of other states. And so that's the concern here as well. It's not just North Carolina that's going to see this.
All right. Moving on then to New Mexico.
Yeah, it's rare, but actually we have states sometimes that pass really good legislation that is worthy of emulation by other states, including Washington State. New Mexico governor signed a bill this week that abolished asset forfeiture in the way that we have come to understand it. Forfeiture in this case being part of the failed drug war, but it's the part where even without a conviction, just on the basis of a charges being filed, local law enforcement agencies, police departments, sheriff's offices, etc., can seize assets and keep those assets as part of their budgets. And we see this in Seattle and King County as well as a number of law enforcement agencies around the country. It creates an incentive for law enforcement agencies to make arrests and for prosecutors to file charges, even when they don't expect to get any kind of a conviction, because there's a financial incentive for doing this, since the assets, which can be kept or sold, then go to the law enforcement agencies who make the arrests. So they've abolished this process in New Mexico now, where they still have forfeiture for drug convictions, but it does require a conviction, and then the forfeiture goes to the state general fund rather than the local law enforcement agency. So it ends the practice of having de facto a financial incentive to make these kind of arrests. Now, asset forfeiture in general as a tactic in the war on drugs, it'd be best to abolish that entirely, but at least it removes the financial incentive for corruption within local law enforcement agencies, and that's a very positive step.
I seem to remember about a month back that the Washington Post did a good series on this, and I can't remember the exact numerical figure, but my impression was nationally it accounted for like around $1 billion a year that's seized.
Yeah, it's become this enormous source of income for law enforcement agencies. And not just an enormous source of income, but one of the other major factors, along with the Department of Homeland Security's various grant programs, and one of the other factors in the militarization of police departments, because they have all this extra money now, which then often goes into not necessarily personnel, but because that's a different part of the budget, but they can go get into weapon procurement and other you know, things that are bought for the operational side of law enforcement agencies, and they wind up getting a lot of new toys with it sometimes. So it then becomes again part of the militarization that we've seen of local law enforcement agencies, even very small agencies, police departments in small towns. They can get these not just because they're getting money from the feds, but also because they're getting money from people they've accused but never convicted.
And it just feeds the cycle that much more, because then you got more weapons to go do more busts that get you more forfeiture items.
Absolutely. Drug raid at 4 a.m. Whoopee. Whoops. Wrong house.
Yeah. All right.
See how many listeners actually know that reference.
All right. Moving on to international and a similar theme. The four Blackwater defendants convicted.
Yeah, and we heard a little bit about this in the 8 o'clock segment in Counterspin, where four defendants for Blackwater convicted and sentenced this week for murder of the 14 Iraqi civilians in Baghdad in 2007. One of those Blackwater personnel guards was sentenced to life in prison, the other three to 30 years in prison, for basically opening fire on a crowd of civilians without any provocation. They had claimed that they were fired upon with AK-47s, but no weapons were ever found. And the conclusion of investigators was that they simply heard something that wasn't there and panicked and let loose with a barrage of different weapons on unarmed civilians, injuring and killing a number of them. We're getting a lot of coverage in media of that conviction in the past week, and the interesting thing about that is that the coverage has been very heavy on the system finally worked, the system works. We've brought these people to justice. That's sort of been the meme, but there's a couple of problems with that. Number one is that it took 8 years for these convictions of the Blackwater personnel, and one of the reasons for that is that originally all U.S. personnel in Iraq were exempt from prosecution for any kind of crimes committed, whether they were private U.S. citizens operating as contractors, as was the case in Blackwater, or U.S. Army and military personnel, because the one massacre in Baghdad that happened in 2007 that was the focus of this particular conviction was one of only many, many instances of civilians being killed in Iraq by U.S. personnel. As we have some sense historically now of the death toll that was inflicted in Iraq, almost all of those who died in Iraq were civilians. There were a relatively small percentage that were actually armed fighters of one sort or another in Iraq. It's a heavily civilian death toll in that particular war, as in most wars now. None of those cases had any kind of prosecution. And the reason for that is that the U.S. Refused to allow the Iraqi government to prosecute any of these folks. And flip that for a second, and you understand how outrageous that is. If you had, say, a Mexican national, say a member of a cartel, come into Seattle and, say, kill 14 people, and then the Mexican government insisting that, no, we can't prosecute those folks. They have to be sent back to Mexico, and Mexico's not going to prosecute them, which is what happened in almost every case of this sort in the United States and Iraq. In this particular case, because it was so egregious, because it got so much attention, and in fact, at that point in the war in Iraq, U.S. public opinion had turned against the war, and this particular massacre really highlighted the role in which private contractors had come to replace U.S. Army personnel in carrying out the war and carrying out the occupation and carrying out foreign policy of the U.S. in Iraq, and was sort of the focus for yet another wave of U.S. public opposition to what was going on in Iraq with U.S. taxpayer dollars. So it was a very high-profile case, but very remarkable and very unusual in that actual investigation and prosecutions finally happened. Once you got out of the Bush administration, which was refusing to hold anybody accountable, the Obama Justice Department did eventually investigate, and a prosecution did eventually happen of these four Blackwater personnel, but not of the numerous other Blackwater personnel, not only who were sort of behind the scenes in this particular massacre and who helped cover up this particular massacre after the case, but also any number of other incidents that happened over the course of the occupation in Iraq. Of course, you would think that murder having no statute of limitations, some of those could still be pursued, but that almost certainly is not going to happen.
And of course, Blackwater getting a bad name during that same time period, and in fact doing a name change, a rebranding, things were
and now they're under their new name, which I believe is XO or something equally unmemorable, getting a number of additional U.S. military and State Department contracts as well. And the contractors in this case, we should say, were contracting for the State Department, I believe, not for the U.S. military. So all arms of the U.S. government that were present in Iraq during that period were equally responsible for a lot of the deaths. I shouldn't say for equally responsible for all the deaths, but were equally problematic in the prosecution or lack of prosecution, lack of accountability for these kind of deaths.
All right. Moving on, ocean acidification.
Yeah, another couple studies out this week regarding climate change, and as is invariably the case for studies involving climate change, things are worse than you not only thought, but worse than you imagined. The first of these, a study in Science magazine, that ocean acidification from volcanoes drove the last and biggest known extinction event in the history of the world, the Permian extinction, which I believe took out the dinosaurs among many, many, many other animals. So ocean acidification triggered by a Siberian trap volcanism was the mechanism for that mass extinction. The ocean alkalinity primed the Earth system with a low level of atmosphere CO2 and a high ocean buffering capacity. So you had two successive waves of acidification that happened, and that killed off many of the existing species in Earth. And the difference between that particular ocean acidification process and what we're seeing now with climate change is that the one now is happening over 1,000 times faster than the one that triggered the Permian extinction. So a very, very sobering study about what the future might be if climate change is not ameliorated and hopefully eventually reversed. Another climate change ocean study, this one in Science News this week, is that even if you did mitigate it, it might take thousands of years for oceans to recover from what has already happened from climate change and what we already know is going to happen. Researchers studied more than 5,400 fossils from a 30-foot-long core sample taken from the Pacific Ocean 4 near Santa Barbara off the California coast, and found that it can take millennia for ocean ecosystems to recover after periods of deoxygenation and warming waters. I can do that part. Climate change, something that is the issue of our times and something that we're not seeing governments either at a local level with Governor Inslee's cap and trade proposal going nowhere in the state legislature, or certainly at the federal level as well, and certainly in terms of international cooperation, really at every level imaginable. Human institutions are not responding adequately to the crisis that has been generated by human institutions. So We got to get going. And that brings us back to the shale oil drilling rig that's coming into the Port of Seattle in the next couple of weeks. Maybe we should do something about that.
All right. Well, that then takes us to events.
Yeah. Caravana 43, which we had hoped to hear from at 7:30, but they still are awesome people. And they have one more event coming up from their tour in this region coming up tonight. Representatives from Ayotzinapa Guerrero in southern Mexico will be at the Southside Commons in South Seattle. That's in Columbia City at 3518 South Edmund Street at 5 o'clock tonight. So hopefully they can get some rest today, because from what we hear, they're pretty darn tired after last night's event. Also tonight at 6 o'clock, Justice for Walter Scott, that being the latest black life that didn't matter, the gentleman that was gunned down in North Charleston, South Carolina a couple weeks ago, that protest will be happening at Westlake Park at 4th and Pine downtown at 6 o'clock tonight. And, a reminder also, last week you probably got some unexpected ballots in the mail for a special election that nobody's heard anything about for a King County regular property tax levy for emergency public radio safety radio network replacement project. Whew, wow. It's a property tax of 7 cents per $1,000 valuation, or about $35 for a $500,000 house per year. That special election for that one proposition is due April 28th, so coming up in another week or so. So get that ballot in the mail. I'm recommending you vote yes on that, and hopefully somebody in the local media will actually pay attention to that particular election and encourage people to turn out.
You know, I got an email from local activist Jack Smith about that particular election. He supports the concept, but he's voting against it. He's very critical of why this is coming about via a special election when it's basically a 20-year, you know, they had a 20-year window on it, and they could have included it in any other existing election. But
yeah,
they're doing a special one that's going to cost taxpayers a certain amount of money.
Yeah, and you talked a little bit about that last week. It really is insane that they're doing a special election, which costs hundreds of thousands of dollars. I think the last don't quote me on this number, but I think the last estimate I saw for special elections for King County was something like $300,000. It's just ridiculous for this one levy that could have appeared on any ballot. And there's a particular reason for this, there's a couple particular reasons. One is the timing, but the timing is driven also by the idea that if you have a special election, which will have a very low turnout, that proponents can get it passed with a minimum of opposition from people who reflexively vote against any tax increase, because they simply aren't aware that the election is happening. We'll see whether that is an effective strategy, because the people who are reflexively opposed to tax increases also tend to be people who vote regularly. So we'll see. But yeah, I tend to agree with Jack on that one, that it should have appeared on a regular ballot. And we have one coming up in August when we have the primary for all the city council seats and so forth, the local elections coming up this year. So they could have waited 3 months or 4 months and voted on it then, but they didn't.
All right.